Welcome to the Kindle Chronicles, the Friday podcast all about your Kindle. I'm Len Edgerly, and this is episode 332 on Friday, December 12th, 2014. Greetings from Cambridge, Massachusetts, where we have not seen the sun at least a week, it seems like more. When friends and family sometimes express surprise that my wife and I'd spend winters in Denver, I always point out that Denver has, on average, 300 days of sun a year, which I don't know what the number is here in Cambridge, but it's a lot less than that. And that does make a noticeable difference in my general mood, and I always find that out when we return to Denver for the first 6 months of the year. We'll be headed there the day after Christmas. The mood at the New York Times Book Review seems pretty upbeat these days, as you will hear in this week's interview with Pamela Paul, who has led the Book Review as editor for more than a year and a half, and who has been asking By the Book column contributors whether they read books electronically or in print.
Some people prefer nonfiction in a print book, while they enjoy fiction on an e-reader, and I think that that kind of balancing of one's reading diet as one does with media overall these days, it kind of makes sense.
Let's go straight to the news. First up, Apple will be back in court on Monday, December 15th, seeking to overturn Judge Denise Coates' verdict against the company in the antitrust suit that Apple has continued to fight while all of its publisher co-conspirators settled, generating millions of dollars of refunds to ebook buyers. The stakes are pretty high for the Apple appeal because if the company eventually loses, it is going to lead to the payment of another $400 million in refunds to customers. Oral arguments are set for Monday, but Apple could conceivably appeal all the way to the Supreme Court if it loses again at the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. Andrew Albanese at Publishers Weekly, I think, has had some of the most in-depth coverage of this story all along, and yesterday his analysis of the appeal left the impression that Apple faces long odds of winning, but it might happen, and in that case, the amount of Apple-provided ebook refunds would be zero. Albanese writes, quote, "Lawyers say it will be an uphill battle for Apple. Look at it this way. To win, Apple must lead the Second Circuit to a completely opposite finding than the slam-dunk verdict Judge Coates came to based on the same evidence and a single brief oral argument. Each side is allotted just 20 minutes. I have a hard time imagining the pressure on Apple's legal team of using those 20 minutes to make a case that has $400 million and the company's reputation to some extent on the line. The Department of Justice will have an equal amount of time to make its arguments that Judge Coates got the case exactly right because the evidence against Apple was, quote, overwhelming, according to the DOJ. Albanese notes that there were more than 8 million pages of evidence produced in discovery leading up to the trial in 2013, and he adds, quote, "One must question whether a judge of Coates' experience could really blow a case as badly as Apple claims happened here. It's not out of the question, but is it likely? Denise Coates is a well-regarded senior judge with a 20-year record." My wife, Darlene, asks me from time to time how the Apple appeal is going. She has a personal interest because the last time refund money flowed in this case from publishers who had settled lawsuits brought a class action suit brought in the matter, she received, I think it was well over $300 worth of refunds from Amazon for all the Kindle purchases that she had made during the period in question. And that payment of ebook credits was in March of this year, and it pretty much kept her in ebooks for until the fall, as I remember. So that refund was only $166 million from the publishers. So whatever you received from that settlement for your ebook purchases between April of 2010 and May of 2012 might turn out to have been less than half of what you will get courtesy of Apple if they end up losing, and if I'm understanding how these numbers tally up with each other. So I'm definitely going to be watching Publishers Weekly on Monday night to see how Andrew Albanese thinks the arguments went that day in court. Next in news is an update on the Fire Phone. I actually heard from another real live Fire Phone owner among you, Bob Anderson, a longtime listener, who reports he's quite happy with it. He has had trouble with the photo app, as I have, but I haven't determined yet if he and I have had the same problem. Mine is that my Fire Phone has been uploading the same 2,000 photos over and over again, even though they appear to already be in the cloud. And I have logged lots of time with the helpful Mayday reps working on this issue. There has been some progress, but as of yet, not a definitive solution. Another thing I noticed this week related to the Fire Phone that concerns me is that there have been a couple of items available for the Fire tablets, the Fire HDX models and the HD 6 and 7, that are not yet available on the Fire Phone. One is the beautifully designed Washington Post app, which is free for 6 months and then costs just $1 for the following 6 months. I use that one every morning and evening on my Fire HD 6 and sometimes on the HDX 8.9. But on my Fire Phone, it's just not available. And I find this pretty disappointing. You know, this is the phone that Jeff Bezos launched with such enthusiasm this summer and that he has stated Amazon has no intention of abandoning. And it can't even run the signature digital innovation app of the newspaper that he himself purchased. I think that's kind of a bad sign. Another is that the Fire Phone does not provide access to Prime Music stations. These are variable streams of music arranged by category if you have a Prime membership on Amazon. And there's some pretty nice ones for the holiday season. For example, there's one called Relaxing Christmas Station, and it features music by Susan Boyle, Harry Connick Jr., Celine Dion, and others. When I called Mayday on this one, they confirmed that Prime stations only work on the Mac or PC or the Fire tablets. So again, this is pretty disappointing for a pioneer Fire Phone owner. And I think if this trend continues of the Fire Phone not keeping up with the Fire tablets and content and various improvements, it's going to make my switch back to the iPhone next year when the Apple Watch is released, even more likely than it is now. My third news story this week is a new font that arrived without much advance notice. Really, there hasn't been much coverage of this at all that I've seen, but I was reading it on my Kindle book on my Fire, and there was a message saying that there was a new font available. It's named Bookerly, and I really like it. I've been happy for years with the Caecilia font. I think it's how you say it, Caecilia. I think that's been the standard for the Kindle for quite a while. Bookerly is very similar. It has serifs instead of the clean, more modern-looking sans-serif fonts like Helvetica and Lucida. Bookerly has serifs, or these are the little flourishes at the ends of the letters, suggesting a vaguely kind of a form of script. To my eye, Bookerly is a little more open, a little more friendly-looking than Caecilia. So far, I have not seen it arrive on my Kindle Voyage, but I expect it will sooner or later. Nice little improvement to the reading experience, I think, this new font, Bookerly. Nice name. For the tech tip, I am going to sing the praises again of the 24/7 Mayday video chat support on the Fire HDX tablets and the Fire Phone. It's not, unfortunately, available on the Fire HD 6 or 7 tablets. Those are priced pretty dramatically low prices that I guess they just couldn't justify the extra cost of Mayday support. So up until now, I have thought of Mayday, which opens a video chat window on your device within seconds of tapping the Mayday button, as kind of a super-duper tech support feature, an innovation by Amazon that no one else that I know of has duplicated. A couple of days ago, though, I realized that Mayday is really more of a tech concierge than a traditional source of tech support and answering questions. Lots of people have places you can call to get help, and when Mayday first arrived, it just looked like it was a different way to provide information that would help you solve problems that you might be having. It's kind of similar to going to the Genius Bar at an Apple store. So this is where I had my epiphany. I was on the cross trainer in the basement a couple of days ago, about to read the Washington Post app on my Fire HDX 8.9 inch, but for some reason the app was frozen on the day before hour's news items. I tried a couple of things to summon the right day's news, all the while working up a sweat, huffing and puffing on the cross trainer. And then I decided to tap on the Mayday button, see if I could get some help that way. A tech arrived in the video window to help. He may have heard my exertions because he didn't even suggest that I tap the screen myself to try to solve the problem. He simply took control from his end. He went back into the settings. He turned off the app, I think, and then turned it on again. He did a couple of things in the settings part of the tablet. Then he navigated back to the Washington Post app to make sure that it was working, and it was. I think this whole encounter from my initial tap of the Mayday button to saying thank you took no more than a minute. And it was as if I had been working out at the Colorado Athletic Club where we work out when we're in Denver and had waved across the room for a tech helper to come fix the machine that I was working on. Instead, I waved through the ether to who knows where the Mayday call center was at that time of the morning, and someone showed up to fix my app. If you have a tablet with this feature and you haven't tried it yet, and I think I've run into people that haven't, it's awkward at first, you know. You're looking at the tech helper. They can't see you, which is good, but it's a new way of interacting with people, and over time I've gotten quite used to it. But if you haven't tried it, I would really urge you to, and in fact, I just think it's a good habit to get into contacting Mayday whenever you've got something you don't understand about your fire, or if there's something you want to do that you haven't figured out yet how to do it. When you build a Mayday connection into your use of these devices, I think it increases the sense of mastery and the usefulness of them. And it's one thing that I really will miss if I end up switching back to an iPhone from this Fire Phone sometime next year. Time now for the interview. Pamela Paul succeeded Sam Tannenhaus as editor of the New York Times Book Review in May of 2013, when she also became host of the Book Review podcast. That's a weekly feast of literary conversations with authors and reporters at the Times. She had previously served as features editor and children's book editor at the Book Review. She is the author herself of three books and the editor of a collection of bookish interviews previously published in the Book Reviews By the Book column. That new volume is titled By the Book, Writers on Literature and the Literary Life from the New York Times Book Review. It was published in late October of this year by Macmillan. The questions posed to authors and other notable tastemakers include questions about what book they're reading, what book they plan to read, what book they has made the most difference in their lives, what book they didn't like. There's one in which she asks which book they would recommend that the president read, and you'll hear us talk about that in the conversation. I reached Pamela on Tuesday, December 9th at her office at the Times in Manhattan, and I began by asking about why she introduced the By the Book column in April of 2012.
Well, there were a few motivating factors. I would say that the largest one was that I've always felt personally that for real readers, you could kind of tell a life story through the books that you've read. And when we ran the first By the Book, which was with David Sedaris, I included a personal essay that I'd written about a book of books that I've kept since 1987, where I write down just the title and author of all the books that I read. And it's really the only journal that I've managed to keep. You know, I've never sort of stuck to a diary of any kind for too long. But this I've managed to keep going. And for me, it's a way of, it's kind of an illustration or an annotation of my life. And I thought that it would be interesting to sort of get that from a lot of the writers, artists, musicians, people that I care about or that I think that our readers might care about. So that was kind of one large motivation. And then, you know, while I'd like to think that book reviews are the only thing that matter to readers in terms of determining what one's going to read next, I recognize that there are a lot of other things, and one of the major ones is really word of mouth. And so this seemed to be a way to kind of create our own word of mouth. It's sort of word of mouth, but from the writers who you like anyway. So it's sort of like a much greater from the horse's mouth version of, you know, Amazon or another search engine sort of recommending something for you. So if you like, for example, Ann Patchett, or if you like Michael Chabon, or if you're a fan of Dave Eggers, this is a way to kind of see what they're reading. It seems to belong within the book review. Now, anytime that we add something new to the book review, we have to think about what that is taking space away from, which is reviews, which is our primary mandate. So, you know, I tend to be generally fairly conservative in terms of how much space we want to devote to other things. But this seemed to fit right in with what we do at the book review.
What has surprised you most about the reaction to it?
Well, you know, I love that it generates opinions. I mean, first of all, I was just happy that it succeeded. The first person I asked to do it was David Sedaris, and the second person was Lena Dunham, and the third was Madeleine Albright, and they all said yes. And I thought, okay, this has got exactly kind of the range that I want. You know, David Sedaris was just an obvious person to ask, because who wouldn't want to know what, you know, makes him laugh? And then Lena Dunham, because at the time, Girls hadn't even aired yet when I asked her, and I just thought we wanted to make sure that it wasn't just sort of the big accepted voices. Now, of course, today she seems like, you know, a huge star and quite mainstream, but when I had proposed her, my editors were like, who is that? Why would we want that person? But I wanted it to be people in their 20s as well as people like Madeleine Albright, who'd had a long career and had just come out with her second memoir. So I was happy that they said yes, and then I was surprised that it was as popular immediately as it was. I mean, it was very rewarding. There are a lot of Q&As out there, and it's kind of hard to try to do something different. And then I would say, you know, within each interview, there's always at least one thing that surprises me that I really just thrown off. You know, you expect that because someone writes a certain way, they might read a certain way, and of course, that's not true. You know, we should know better. That's not true. You can meet a carpenter, and they might read poetry, or you can meet a fourth grade school teacher, and they might really like David Foster Wallace. Like, you just don't know what someone's reading tastes are going to be like. So it's just kind of constantly upending expectations in a really good way.
How often have you been turned down by someone who you approached to do the questions?
I can count it on one hand.
Do you care to say any of them, who they were?
No, because hopefully I'll still convince them to reconsider. Yeah. I definitely have some people I plan to go back to at some point. You know, there were a number of people that when I asked at the very beginning, there were two no's. There's been, I think, maybe one or two since then. But they're on a secret list of mine, and I'll be back.
Well, with all of the advice that you've collected for President Obama to read, I would think it'd be natural to think of posing these questions to him himself.
Yeah, wouldn't that be fun? You know, we don't really do people that are currently in office. We interviewed Hillary Clinton, of course, but that was after she had resigned as Secretary of State. So hopefully when Obama has moved on to other positions, he'll consider filling one out. You know, the other thing that I find interesting about that particular question is I don't specify Obama. I just say the president. You know, it would be like the person who in theory might, you know, inhabit that office at any moment in time or, you know, or permanently. So people answer it actually in different ways. Some people see it as specifically about Obama, and then that says a lot about their politics in terms of how they answer, and others think of it as just sort of the theoretical president. Hmm. And some I ask about the prime minister.
Yes, that's right. You got to consider the country.
That's right.
When you selected the columns to include in the collection that Macmillan published, you got 65 in that book. How were you sorting which ones to put in the book and which ones to not include?
Well, it was hard, actually. You know, it's funny. I hadn't planned to do a by-the-book book right away, but there was interest in doing a version of it in China. And I thought, well, you know, I feel like we ought to go first with our own book before there's a Chinese language version of it. So that kind of sort of sped me up in terms of my plans for doing one. And I thought, well, are we going to have enough material? And then I realized that actually, you know, not everyone could make the cut. So that was tough. And we just mostly tried to get a broad range so that, you know, it wasn't necessarily all the biggest names, that it might be a mix of new names and just other people who did with whom it was a really good interview. You know, some are more interesting than others, I have to admit, and though I'd like to say they're all fantastic. So it was kind of weighing all of those various considerations, and then I'll just have to hope that there's a volume two so that I can pick up everyone we missed. And, you know, the other thing that was is that ultimately we had to send the manuscript off to the printing press and sort of stop including people. And it felt like, as it often does, like all the good people came, you know, right after we sort of cut off the entry point. It's not true. But I do, some of my favorites have been after the book was finished. And so hopefully I'll get a chance to do another one.
I could picture an ebook version of it where you, you know, included all of the interviews, say, for each year. And then what would be really cool is if you had links in the ebook so that you could, you know, buy them at Barnes & Noble or Amazon or wherever, because it's such a handy way to find books that a book lover is going to want to read. And if you had a way to do that that was more frictionless, I would think it'd be very successful.
I actually want there to be a teleportation button on title, and you just enter the book directly. But wouldn't it be nice to suddenly be at a, you know, literary dinner party with I don't know, Mark Twain and Shakespeare and Edith Wharton? But yeah, no, I think that there is, you know, a lot of possibilities for people to go directly to either reading the book or buying the book. Or the more directly you can get a book into someone's hand, the happier I will be.
I'm a Times Premier subscriber, so I get some nice ebooks that come each month, and collecting those essays for one of those ebooks that the Premier subscribers can get would be, I think, a pretty cool idea.
Yes, and you know, there's also for Premier subscribers, buy the books with some of our own editors and columnists, which you've probably seen.
Well, one question, it looks like you've stopped asking, I think at least since April, was reading preferences, specifically ebook versus print. Why did you sort of rotate that one out of the questions that you usually ask?
Oh, I think I've rotated it back in. you know, it's a constant, it's in constant flux, and some questions go away and come back, and others are altogether new, and I don't know that I've actually retired any questions permanently. Because, you know, you do want to keep it fresh and interesting. So I think that one just probably had a little resting period.
What, in general, have you learned about people's preferences between ebook and print and from the times that you've asked that question?
Well, I think that a lot of, you know, we're asking a very specific group of people, and they're largely writers. And writers, I think, in general, tend to be nostalgically and for other reasons just attached to print. But I think that in many ways that what we're seeing in Buy the Book, and it's such a small, you know, body that it's hard to draw major generalizations about e-reading patterns from it. But I would say it probably mirrors what you're seeing in the sort of larger reading public, which is that after a period of rapid growth, there's now a tapering off and a kind of a mix-and-match sort of approach. Mm-hmm. You know, many people who bought an e-reader of some kind or another will use it for some things and not for others. Some people use it to travel, but at home they like to read a book. Some people use it for genre fiction, but not for literary fiction. Some people prefer nonfiction in a print book while they enjoy fiction on an e-reader. And I think that kind of balancing of one's reading diet as one does with media overall these days, it kind of makes sense, you know. I mean, in the same way that, you know, I read the New York Times in print, I like the paper version, and I would never want anything else, even though I do check it periodically during the day online. There are other publications that I only read online. So just because, you know, I get my news from Twitter or this website or this news alert or app doesn't mean that I'm not still reading print. I still subscribe to a number of magazines in print. So I think that, you think that that's happened to people's media consumption overall, and so I think that's what's happening in books.
Well, turning to the podcast, how do you see the podcast's role in relation to the online and the print versions of the book review?
You know, it's another component. I mean, it would be delightful, but I doubt we have too many hardcore people who are, you know, listening and looking at all three formats. I think that the podcast is, you know, for many people, it's either their first look at the book review, or if they didn't quite get at it over the weekend, they might listen to the podcast and then sort of read it later in the week. It's sort of an enhancement rather than a replacement of the book review. I try not to be duplicative in terms of the content, because that's just not interesting. You know, it wouldn't be interesting for me, obviously, and then I think that would then come across in interviews that I was, you know, just going through the route. I'm not interested in sort of hearing someone regurgitate their review or give me like a book summary of what their book is about. At the same time, for those listeners of the podcast who are only listening to the podcast, I don't want them to sort of be at sea and not have a sense of like, wait, what is this book and who reviewed it? So it's kind of trying to come up with that complementary mix.
When you sit down for an interview with an author for the podcast, what do you hope will happen?
I hope for a good conversation. When my first book came out in 2002, and I was booked for a number of radio interviews, I was very nervous, and I asked a writer who'd done a bunch of media for advice, and he said, remember, you know, it's just got to be entertaining, you know, it's just got to be interesting. And so I tend to approach these interviews in two ways. First, as a reader, someone who, hey, what's this book about? What was this review like? What do I want to know? And that, I think, is kind of sitting in for the listener. And then the second is as a journalist and as a, you know, in a little bit of a more professional capacity, like, how did you write that? You know, you've got, you know, Hector Tovar, for example, you've got this book about these miners and there's dozens of them. How did you manage that with all those characters? How did you balance it? Or you've been working, you know, say, Akhil Sharma on this novel for 13 years. What were you doing those whole, you know, during that 13 years? Did you write one version and sort of toss it away? Were you working on this the whole time? So I'm interested in a little bit of kind of the process and with nonfiction and with fiction, but just the approach, the research, what's behind the book.
When you're preparing for an interview, are you spending a lot of time just with the author's work, or do you go to other interviews to get a feel for what they've said previously? What's your pattern there?
You know, in an ideal world, if I were only hosting a podcast every week, then that's what I would do. I would, like, you know, just marinate and research and read everything they'd ever written. And unfortunately, you know, I don't have the time, sadly, to do all of that. And so, you know, in a certain way, it can work to your advantage because it means that you're really approaching it fresh and you want to, you know, you've got genuine questions that are probably somewhat similar to the listener's questions who, you know, might not have heard of Michelle Faber, who just wrote, you know, the book of Strange New Things, and might not know who the reviewer Marcel Theroux is. And, you know, they sort of want to get that basic, you know, who, what, when, where, why.
I'm sure you're aware the role of Amazon is a polarizing topic among book lovers and authors, even with the resolution of the recent public controversy between Amazon and Hachette over the contract. I've never heard you directly criticize or defend Amazon on the Book Review podcast. Is that a fray that you hope to keep the Book Review above or out of?
You know, publishers, Amazon is a publisher at this point as well as a distributor. I don't really comment on any of them. You know, that's just not my role at the Book Review. Like, we have a publishing reporter, Alexander Alter, at the paper, and sort of that's, and we have a technology reporter, David Streitfeld, who covers Amazon, and sort of I see it as their bailiwick, and ours is really about the books and about the writers.
Well, let's finish with some of the questions you ask others. What are you reading now?
I'm reading a book that I'm so delighted to be able to recommend. It's not a new book, but it's a great memoir, Act One by Moss Hart. It came out in 1959, and Moss Hart, of course, was one of the great playwrights. He wrote some screenplays. He did My Fair Lady right now. There's a revival of You Can't Take It With You on Broadway. And Act One is a memoir about the theater, it's a memoir about the creative process, it's a memoir about New York, about sort of making your way in life. Moss Hart was born in the Bronx, in poverty, no connections, nothing in terms of exposure to the arts, but for an aunt who took him to the theater sort of on the sly, and despite having to quit school at the age of 13 and go to work in a furrier's factory or an office, that he basically was carrying these sort of wet furs in the fashion district. And he went from that to being one of the most, you know, successful, acclaimed playwrights of his time. And this memoir is just sort of about that path, about early childhood, and sort of takes him up to, I'm not quite finished with it, but having seen the play which was recently based on the memoir, kind of Know Where It Stops, which is kind of right at the moment where, you know, he first sees success. So it's not a memoir of all the famous and wonderful people he knew and all the riches he achieved, but the road to getting there. And it's incredibly funny, really well written. This is someone who did not have an education to speak of, and yet is such a stylist. It was recommended to me by many people, and now I feel like I will be in turn recommending it, you know, pretty much anyone who will listen.
Yeah, what's the title of that one again?
It's called Act One by Moss Hart, and it was just recently reissued.
And are you reading on e-readers or in print?
I am a huge reader of print. I've worked in a bookstore growing up. I lived around the corner from my public library. I collect books. I will own sometimes 3 or 4 or 5 copies of different books simply because I like the cover or the text treatment or the feel of it or even the book glue, which I do in a purely legal way. So I'm a huge reader of old-fashioned print. During the day, my life is highly screen-oriented, and so my sort of my pleasure time and my reading time is print.
Yep, that's a nice respite. I've been speaking with Pamela Paul, editor of the New York Times Book Review and of By the Book, Writers on Literature and the Literary Life from the New York Times Book Review, published in October by Macmillan. Thanks very much, Pamela.
Thank you, Len.
After my conversation with Pamela, I realized I had forgotten to ask one important question that was on my list, namely, has the book review reviewed any books that were self-published by authors? And if not, is that something she might consider in the future? I emailed that question to her afterward, and she quickly sent back this reply. No, we do not. I never say never to anything, but it's not part of our current plans. Much as I am a supporter of the self-publishing movement, I guess I can understand her reluctance to add this large and growing source of possible books to review to those already arriving each week at the Times. As it is, the book review has room for reviews of probably just about 1% of the books traditionally published in the U.S. in any year. I'm glad that she declined to say never to reviews of self-published books. I can actually imagine that position changing sometime in the future, perhaps the first time a self-published title wins one of the top literary book awards. You know, that could happen someday. It might not happen soon, but I wouldn't bet on never for that one either. The first thing I'd like to talk to you about in content is I'm going to follow up on my mention of Darlene's voracious reading habits to pass along a list of mystery writers that she recommends. This came about because a friend of mine in Casper, Wyoming, Jack, who's in his 80s, has run out of mystery writers, and he asked if Darlene could suggest some new ones to try. She asked Jack for a list of mystery writers that he has enjoyed in the past in order to help her choose some of her favorites that he might like to try that might be similar. So they each chose 7 authors, and I think this will give you 14 authors to try if you're looking for something new in mysteries. I have links to all of these authors and where you can see the books in their series at the show notes at thekindlechronicles.com. I'll begin with Jack's list. First on it was Faye Kellerman, and the series is the Peter Decker and Rena Lazarus Crime Thrillers series. Next, there's J.A. Jantz, J.A.N.C.E., the J.P. Beaumont series. And then Catherine Coulter, the FBI series, Michael Connelly, the Harry Bosch series, Sue Grafton, of course, the Alphabet series. Each book is based on a letter. Archer Mayer, the Joe Gunther novels, and L.J. Sellers, Detective Jackson mysteries. Those are Jack's books that he's enjoyed in the past. So that prompted the following list from Darlene. First on it is John Sanford, the Virgil Flowers series, followed by C.J. Box, the Joe Pickett series, Craig Johnson, Walt Longmire mysteries, Donna Leon, Commissario Guido Brunetti mysteries, Joseph Flynn, that's the Jim McGill series, James Patterson, Women's Murder Club series. She writes, these are old but good, the first ones are the best. And then the last on Darlene's list is Julia Spencer Fleming. I also want to tell you about another work that I've been enjoying myself for the past week or so. It's an Audible drama written by the thriller writer Jeffrey Deaver titled The Starling Project. What's noteworthy about this is that this creation is not available in book form. There's no plans for it to be available in a book form. It exists only as an audiobook, or as Audible is calling it, an Audible drama. Deaver, who has published 35 novels and sold 40 million copies of his work worldwide, told Alexandra Alter of the New York Times that this new form presented some new challenges, but that he likes being able to build a new audience of listeners. There's a quote from Deaver. He said, "There are so many time-wasting alternatives to reading out there, and authors are up against formidable competition with things like Assassin's Creed, Minecraft, Angry Birds. This is an easier way for people to get access to good storytelling." Audible has commissioned and produced about 30 original works, Alter's article reported. I am about halfway through the Starling Project, which runs more than 4 hours. There's no narrator. You're just right in the middle of the story. You hear the sounds of the characters speaking to each other, along with some music sometimes and some sound effects. Deaver wrote the script in a way that gives the listener good clues as to who's talking and what action is taking place. And it's a pretty terrific performance, in my view. It offers unique possibilities. In one sequence involving the disarming of an explosive device, real seconds are ticking by as you're listening. So the suspense is really exquisite, because you're right there with the seconds passing in the story at the same time as you're hearing them. That's something you just wouldn't hear in a book that had been written first for print and then maybe ported over as an audiobook. In a written book, you would create that time element in your imagination, and that's good too. But this thriller is written precisely for this medium, and those seconds ticking by are really as if you're in the story. I love just the newness of this, and bravo to Jeffrey Deaver for jumping in and taking on a project like this. He's obviously got a successful formula for writing books and having them show up as audiobooks, but to take on this new form in, I think, a pretty high-quality way. The actors' voices are fun to listen to, some English accents and other. There's a DC cop, and they're all trying to chase some nefarious group, and at this point I don't know exactly what they're going to find out or how they're going to solve it, but it moves at a very brisk pace. Here's a little sample of it just so you can hear the quality of this performance.
Okay, so long, Davey. I'm kind of sorry.
What the hell's that all about?
The office at the far end, Lieutenant. That's where the shot came from.
All right. You stay here, Harry, Miss Tadich, Murray. We go up that corridor fast. At the office, you go left, I go right, both low.
Roger that. Now!
Hey, what's going on?
Lieutenant Summers.
It's safe to come in, Senor Middleton.
Let's go.
That's a clip from The Starling Project, an Audible drama written by Jeffrey Deaver. Highly recommended. Time now for some comments that I've received. Lorraine Little has received her Amazon Echo, and she sends this report. I received my Echo about a week ago, she writes. I must say it is fun. Right now I use it more as a Bluetooth speaker. I wanted to buy one, and this one does so much more. I listen to Prime Music and ask at the time. I have never used the timer and alarm. I can see how this little Echo has great possibilities. I had zero trouble installing. My router hub is upstairs and far away, but it linked up quickly. She, meaning Alexa, the Echo, understands me most of the time. Sometimes I have to rephrase a question or command. I hope you get your invite soon. Lorraine. Thanks, Lorraine, for that message. I, too, hope that my invite arrives soon. Drew Holmes wrote this week as follows. So I took my family and my two 93-year-old grandmothers to the Nutcracker on Saturday, and we got there early to help seat the grandparents. Thinking I would have extra time, I brought my Kindle to read before the event. On our way out, I was focused on helping my grandmothers navigate the stairs and left my Kindle sitting next to my seat. I failed to realize this until the next day. The Kindle was not found at first and appeared nobody turned it in to lost and found, and a search around my seat on my return trip resulted in no Kindle. What do you do when you lose a Kindle? I never thought of it before. I deactivated the device so anyone who found it would not charge thousands of dollars worth of books to it through my account. If they reactivated it under another account, could Amazon track them down? While I was pondering these thoughts, I got a late night call that someone had turned it in and they had set it aside from the regular lost and found, so all ended well. Your thoughts? Drew asks. Well, my thoughts are, first of all, it's pretty cool to have two grandmothers who have reached the age of 93, and I love imagining that trip to the Nutcracker. And I'm glad that Drew's Kindle was returned. Deregistering it, I think, was the right move because that meant no one could charge to his account. I don't think Amazon has the ability to see a lost Kindle reactivated, or it may be corporate policy not to try and snatch one, even if it's reported stolen. When we were accepting donated Kindles for eBooks for Troops, we received about 40 that had amazingly been left on SkyWest planes. That's just one airline. The airline had attempted to get information about the owners, but to no avail, so they updated the software on them and donated them to us, and we shipped them to U.S. soldiers deployed overseas. I myself left a Kindle on a train from Boston to Old Orchard Beach a few years ago. Luckily, it was fetched and delivered to Amtrak's Lost and Found Department in Portland, Maine, so I was able to retrieve it. I think I found out that it was safely in the Portland train station even before I went ahead to deregister it. Moral of the story is, keep your Kindle close. If you've got a Kindle Voyage, it just slips in a sports coat pocket, pretty easy to keep with you. And if you do lose it, you want to deregister it right away. And finally, another Amazon product launch, which didn't receive quite as much attention as Echo, is the unlocked Fire Phone, selling for, I think it's up to $299 now, but originally it came out at $199. George from Tulsa bought one not to use as a phone, but more like what he calls a Fire Touch. Here is his report. The Fire Phone is surprisingly heavy. I think that's because of the glass back and maybe because of all the hardware for the dynamic perspective. That's a kind of 3D effect. George continues, I was somewhat disappointed in the stereo speakers as I turned on one Willie Nelson song and it wasn't so great. Still, I could hear it clearly. It got hand-warmingly hot quickly, and all I can figure out was it was all that dynamic perspective stuff, constantly running the high-power Qualcomm Snapdragon 800 processor while looking for input. I enjoyed briefly the falling leaves lock screen. I tried the sort of 3D monkey game. Again, it's nice to look around a little bit, but hardly worth a phone that becomes hot to touch. I turned off all the dynamic perspective stuff and the phone cooled down. I'm hopeful that it will increase its battery life because it was the fastest fading battery in any recent new device I've ever used. The lack of useful and meaningful voice input was disappointing, George continues. I had thought it would be possible to say to the phone, play music, stop music, play audiobook, stop audiobook, and get weather like the Amazon Echo. I just kept getting a nice voice saying, I can't do that yet. The Fire interface is puzzling and confused. It differs from the Fire tablets, from iOS, and from stock Android, and yet is similar enough that the differences create user interface issues. Where to look for features and controls is not clear because of those differences. The camera seems very good, surprisingly good, and a dedicated shutter button. I wish all phones had one. The Kindle Reader program is also very good, and the screen is excellent. The text-to-speech function, which is what caused me to want to buy it, is also excellent. So overall, I'm going to get my $100 worth, and I'm sure it will replace my brand new Kindle Fire HD 6 as something to carry around all the time. Quite a bargain at $199 with the free $100 of Prime. George's first impressions of the Fire Phone track my own, though I have come to appreciate the Firefly feature, and I've seen improvements since I switched from an iPhone more than 3 months ago. Updates make it easier to create a new event, for example. That's it for this week. My guest next week will be Richard Hollick, who writes Making Book, a highly informed and insightful blog about the publishing world that you can find at rhollick.wordpress.com. Richard was last on the show just over a year ago, and I'm looking forward to talking with him on Tuesday for next week's TKC 333. If you are shopping on Amazon this season and would like to support the podcast without paying any more for your purchases, I hope you will consider beginning your Amazon navigation by clicking on one of the display ads that you'll find for Amazon at thekindlechronicles.com. That's the show notes page. This helps generate Amazon Associates commissions that go toward hosting and other costs of putting this show on. This is Len Edgerly for the Kindle Chronicles in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I really appreciate your listening to my podcast. Have a great day. Bye.